From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grolot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Today I'm joined once again by my colleague Erica Larkins. She just returned to Oklahoma after a year-long OU assignment in Brazil, and she'll offer her takeaways from the Olympics that wrapped up Sunday.
I think everyone wanted this to be a great success, and I think that Brazilians are proud of how it went. I think they do feel like they showed the world that they could do this.
But first, Rebecca Cruz, Joshua Landis, and I discuss Turkey's recent military moves in Syria and North Korea's testing of a submarine-launched missile.
What is different this time is that China has joined in saying that they are against this sort of activity. So that is significant because China has always kind of been an obstacle to any sort of activities to prevent North Korea from doing these sorts of things.
That's all coming up after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grolot. Joshua Landis, welcome back from the summer. It's good to have you back in the studio. We need a Middle East update. We haven't had one for a while due to travel schedules and such. But so tell us what's going on, particularly the latest news on Turkey and Syria and kind of what's happening on the border there.
Well, it's a big change. Turkey has moved its tanks and men into Syria. Turkey has been resisting getting into Syria. In the first year of the Syrian uprising, the United States was urging Turkey to get involved and to move into Syria and saying that the U.S. would follow behind. And Turkey resisted. It looked at Syria as a potential Vietnam, but today it's gone in. Now, the question is why? And that's largely because of the growing Kurdish state that's emerging along the northern border of Syria. And the Kurds have met with tremendous success expanding their territory, largely because the United States has teamed up with them in order to destroy ISIS. So the Kurds have been taking territory away from ISIS and expanding their state from the east of Syria, the border with Iraq, right across the northern stretch of border, which is about 600, 700 kilometers with Turkey. And it looks like it could build a contiguous state along that entire stretch of the border. Turkey has been saying no, no Kurds west of the Euphrates River, which cuts through the middle of Turkey. And yet they went through with American blessing, took a big city called Minbij, kicking out the Islamic State. So Turkey finally had enough and has moved in there. And it looks like they've moved their army in with the blessing of the United States, because U.S. airplanes and U.S. trained Syrian opposition troops went there with them. So the United States, to a certain extent, has limited the expansion of the Kurds and has teamed up with Turkey, getting them involved in the fight against ISIS, but really as a way to limit the expansion of the Kurds.
Well, is this a bit of a shift? Because, you know, Turkey had always been wanting to go after Assad. And so it's just like you said, they've just had enough of what was going on in terms of the relationship between ISIS and the Kurds. But what are the consequences here? I mean, what are the
big
consequences for exactly what for Syria, Turkey, the United States, and all the other players that are now involved?
The Turkish prime minister said just today, he said, we have to prioritize and we want to stop the Kurdish expansion ahead of trying to overturn Assad. So in a sense, the Russians have said nothing to condemn this. And that means the Russians have made a deal that it'll be a limited incursion to stop the Kurds, and that the Turks have shifted from saying Assad out to Assad has to get out after a transitional period.
Well, one more thing to watch, obviously big developments there in Syria. So, Rebecca, other big news this week coming out of North Korea. Now, we're quite familiar with the fact that the North Koreans occasionally, you know, test a missile and they're getting bigger and better missiles as time is going by. This was a pretty big deal this week, though, a submarine-launched missile that traveled about 500 kilometers and landed in Japanese waters. And, of course, the timing being one that has to do with the South Koreans and the Americans, of course, starting their military exercises together this week. So making a statement. But the reaction is, you know, just there's a lot of words, obviously. It's provocative. It's unacceptable. But what are you know, the North Koreans eventually going to be held accountable for any of this? Or is this just we're going to live with North Korean nuclear subs from now until the future?
Well, there's a very big question there, and trying to figure out the answer to that is not easy. Yes, we're seeing condemnation. I think this time around, it is significant, that condemnation. We're hearing that the UN may actually come out with a declaration opposed to this activity. Now, yes, that's just a declaration. But in the past, where the United States has crafted language for the UN to come out opposed to what North Korea is doing, they've always been blocked by China. What is different this time is that China has joined in saying that they are against this sort of activity. They have a joint statement with Japan and South Korea. So that is significant, because China has always kind of been seen as, if not a partner, a country that has gone along with North Korea and has been an obstacle to any sort of activities to prevent North Korea from doing these sorts of things. So perhaps that is a step in the right direction. Now, other options, economic options, that's a little bit difficult. Military options, also difficult. So it's really hard to know what to do here. Isolating them, they're already predominantly isolated.
So what about the Chinese? The Chinese have a role to play here? I mean, they're just kind of sitting back and watching North Korea do these sorts of things. What role do they have to play?
Well, all those things that I just mentioned, if they are going to be effective, China's going to have to be the country to do them. China can further isolate them. China can further put on economic sanctions. China has a military that could get involved. Will they? That's a big question. But they seem to be at least moving in the direction of at least expressing their discomfort with what's going on.
Well, again, the timing being an issue, the North Koreans seem to do these things regularly. Maybe it's just attention getting. We'll see. All right, Joshua, Rebecca, thank you so much as always for your insight.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this show or answer any questions you may have. Send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU, or you can contact me directly at Suzette Gorelot. Coming up, University of Oklahoma anthropologist Erica Larkins joins me in the studio after her year in Rio de Janeiro. We'll talk about the success and some of the issues she saw while studying the Olympics that officially ended Sunday. I'm Suzette Gorelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelot. Over the past few weeks, we've checked in several times with University of Oklahoma anthropologist Erica Larkins. She just returned to Norman last week after spending a year living and working in Rio. She's been studying the security preparations and response to the 2016 Summer Olympics that ended Sunday. Erica Larkins, welcome back to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me.
It's always great to have you here and to catch up on Brazil. You are fresh back in the country, having just spent the past year in Brazil. And of course, the Olympics, which was a big part of your whole life in the past year. You've been studying it, you're writing a book about it, about security at the Olympics. So you spent a lot of time with the Olympic officials and had kind of an insider view. Now, we've talked coming up to the Olympics about what to expect and kind of how things are going to play off now. But overall, I mean, we didn't see any of the potential difficulties or challenges they were facing, certainly there in Rio. But were there many? I mean, give us the more accurate view of what perhaps you saw there.
I don't think that there really were not that many. I mean, I think overwhelmingly it went off without a hitch. You know, of course, the representation in the media up until the very end, I think, was pretty critical. I think a lot of people were complaining that the services weren't as good as they were in London. And that they'd paid a lot of money for tickets and, you know, in some cases the venues ran out of food. You know, you couldn't even get a bag of popcorn without standing in line for, you know, an hour. But maybe that kind of stuff doesn't really matter. Maybe, you know, and so I think this is maybe the where Rio has a gold medal is that maybe the Olympics are really about sports and about, you know, people coming together, and all of that aesthetic stuff just doesn't matter.
So there were some very interesting events that happened throughout. Obviously, as if Ryan Lochte didn't get enough press or, you know, attention from what happened with that scandal, the lie about being mugged at gunpoint. But I want to bring it up because the Brazilians obviously took this very personally. I mean, it's like the Brazilians were expecting everything to go well, and we're working hard, I guess. Let's put it that way, working hard for it to go well. And so this was something that they just couldn't stand for. They couldn't, you know, they didn't want something like this to happen, but then they certainly wanted to demonstrate that it didn't happen. It was more of a PR move, perhaps, on the Brazilian part.
Yeah, I think it was also, you know, deeply insulting to a lot of Brazilians. And maybe one detail of the story in particular, which was that, you know, when Lochte invented this story, he said that he had been robbed by police, by men. Maybe they were police or they were wearing police uniforms.
You know, remember that there was something like 80,000 security personnel that were deployed to Rio for the Olympics. Those people took, I mean, how does it feel when you've spent years preparing for something like that and your number one goal is to keep athletes safe, to suddenly sort of have your profession being represented as dishonest people that would potentially hold up, you know, swimmers at gunpoint on a dark night. And I think that, you know, maybe in some ways that's why the story didn't end. That's why we actually found out what happened, because I think that those people took this invention very, very personally, because it was a criticism of the security apparatus there and also a criticism of all of the work that they had done to keep athletes safe.
And possibly even Brazilian culture. I mean, it's highlighting, you know, one of the stereotypes, if you will. I mean, and stereotypes are based in part at least on some truth, but the stereotype that Rio is a very dangerous place. And, you know, and a lot of people actually didn't go because of the concerns with their safety and security and then, of course, health, which I want to get to. Mm-hmm. But they worked hard, as you said, to try to prevent that, but it also kind of perpetuates that view that Brazil is an unsafe country and that Rio in particular is an unsafe city.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's partly, you know, why people were so upset. I mean, the idea that it could be true, you know, was deeply insulting to people. And I think it raised another point, you know, which is maybe this is a takeaway for the larger Olympics. You know, is this about sports or is this about huge athlete parties and, you know, sponsor houses that are for, you know, the elite, or is this sort of something for everyone? And I think where Lochte took a lot of flack in, you know, social media and in the press was that, you know, these are very privileged athletes coming from sort of the quote unquote developed world, treating somewhere like Rio as a place that's just there for, you know, them to make a mess of. And I think that sort of dynamic was a really important one that the case showed us.
Did some of that play out in the sports, too? It seems like we've seen a few stories here and there of how, again, kind of developed versus, you know, developing world, you know, which is something that I guess plays out in most Olympics. I mean, again, the athletes that are able to train, you know, in the developed world that have that those kind of financial resources, the support for a team like, you know, the United States Olympic team, that, you know, which won, of course, an enormous number of medals, that there really is almost a perpetuation of the divide between the global north and the global south in some way.
No, absolutely. And people noted that, you know, watching the Olympics. At one point, you know, when I was in the security center, somebody said, oh, Michael Phelps has more medals than Brazil does. You know, and also I would get asked a lot, you know, well, how do you feel? You know, are you rooting for the U.S. or are you rooting for Brazil? And it's true, you know, that there's that it's not, you know, sports aren't democratic either. It's not always about who's the best athlete. It's about who has the best training, who had the best equipment. You know, of course, there's these natural talent issues also, but, you know, it isn't. It's about opportunity and access to resources. And that's, you can see that a lot in the opening ceremonies when you look at the number of the delegations, how big the U.S. is, how many athletes they send, you know, as opposed. So I always end up voting for, you know, rooting for the country that has like one athlete that was able to send one person.
Right. The underdogs and like the refugee team. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, there was just a team that perhaps, you know, was representing people from around the world and was being kind of cheered on, you know, around the globe. And so there were so many great stories like that. People that engaged in great sportsmanship, you know, that would the runners that fell and then helped each other up and crossed the line. And I think we're provided a medal for that. But then also bad sportsmanship comes out too, right? There was some of the track and field controversies and of course the Russian controversy with the doping scandal, which we've talked on the show about in the past couple of weeks. So, I mean, I guess the Olympics, like most things, you get a little bit of everything, politics, history, culture, and of course, great, you know, human stories and then challenging stories or competition.
Yeah, and I think you can absolutely see that in the media coverage. You know, I heard here that you know, NBC was very criticized for sort of overdoing the human interest story. On the Brazilian side, there was none of that at all. So and something else, there was no commercials or very few commercials. So literally, you were just watching the sports. And so it was weird because when we watch the Olympics, so much of what makes it for us or what makes it more interesting are those stories. And so it was interesting seeing it in, you know, from Rio and not having that. At the same time, you can kind of feel the energy around it by being there live, which is really different.
That's Erica Larkins, an anthropologist who just spent the past year in Rio de Janeiro. We'll talk more about the media coverage and the Brazilian response to the Olympics. I'm Suzette Grolat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grolat, the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. I've been talking with University of Oklahoma anthropologist Erica Larkins about her experience living and working in Rio de Janeiro studying the Brazilian response to the Olympics. Just before the break, she described some of the differences between U.S. and Brazilian media coverage of the event.
It is an interesting point on how different countries do treat these types of big events, because I can tell you, having watched it every night here in the United States, there were a lot of commercials, and it's highly commercialized. And it was almost like watching the Super Bowl every day, right? I mean, people pull out their biggest and best commercials because that's where the people are watching at that point in time. So it's a very different treatment.
Yeah, and it's not, I mean, and I think in some ways this is maybe a good lesson from Rio is that maybe all of that commercialization is too much. You know, maybe people don't want that. Maybe people also just want to see the sports and not get all the stories.
Well, certainly there was some criticism as well here in the United States about treatment of athletes, you know, these human interest stories, treating them differently. You know, female athletes that were, you know, their victories were credited to their, you know, male counterparts or their male, you know, coaches or their male spouses or whatever. But you know, not so much for the men. I mean, did you see that kind of reflection in Brazil as well? I mean, there were a lot of Brazilian female athletes that did very well at the Olympics. And so how are they perceived vis-a-vis, you know, their male counterparts, the male athletes?
I think it's really similar, you know, to here. You could also see it in the stadiums. You know, the women's sports, with the exception of gymnastics, tended to have lower attendance, and the tickets were less expensive. And so, you know, it's the same, I think, the same kinds of dynamics that you see. I've always said about Olympics and about mega events in general is that they're not separate from everything else. It's not just this exceptional Olympics. They're just places where you can see all these other dynamics happening in greater relief. It's sort of easier to see because of the sort of volume and the spectacle of the event itself. So it doesn't surprise me that there's these same issues around, you know, gender and inequality, around democracy, around how to develop, you know, developed versus developing world. It makes sense that all of these things would appear.
That they all play out in that mm-hmm. type of environment. Well, so tell us a little bit about the Brazilian response, because I know there were some protests. There were some stories of those who protested, especially here. You know, Brazil is, of course, a very important regional player, but they're spending, you know, their financial situation isn't the best. I mean, they're struggling economically, and yet they've spent an enormous amount of money on these Olympics. Obviously, countries, you know, choose to do that because they think they're going to make money, but it almost always doesn't pan out that way. But what is the kind of economic response and the social response to this big event from that perspective in terms of affecting kind of political life day to day?
Now I think there's going to be like a post-Olympic, I don't know, like a mega event hangover, I guess, for a lack of a better way of putting it. You know, there's been this whole story about the buildup. Can we do it? Can we pull it off? Is it going to be a disaster? And what would that mean to us? Now, I think, you know, and even, I mean, the people that protested the most against the Olympics, that objected the most, while they were still critical, I don't think anyone wanted this to go badly. I think everyone wanted this to be a great success. And I think that Brazilians are proud of how it went. I think they do feel like they showed the world that they could do this. Now, the question is, the economy is in the tank. The political situation is very divided. I mean, the country is very divided. And, you know, none of that's going to change anytime soon. So now what? And I think that's really unclear. You know, there was some political protest during the Olympics, not anything big or violent or anything, but people simply holding up signs, you know, against the interim president and, you know, questioning the state of Brazilian democracy. And, you know, those were very quickly, the camera would pan away from those very quickly. They tried very hard to sort of scrub all images of that from the broadcast. And, you know, even in the opening ceremonies, the interim president chose not to be introduced because he didn't want to be booed. This is like the first time that's ever happened, and it's an enormous break with protocol. So I think that just indicates how deeply divided things are, and sort of what the way out of that now is going to be is sort of yet to be seen. I don't think it's going to be an easy one. And I think it's going to be hard for them to find consensus. You know, and also, up until now, the mayor in Rio has been able to, is a very important political figure, has really been able to sort of keep a lid on
investigations into where all the money for the Olympics has gone. Who got the building contracts? Was this all done fairly or not? And I think already with the close of the Olympics, you're starting to get a little bit of a push to open those books more. So I think there's going to be some questions about whether or not all of this, you know, the beautiful games were built on practices that were not very equitable. You know, and I think we're probably going to find out that the answer is yes to that. And it'll be interesting to see if that's going to really tarnish the people's opinion of how the Olympics went off overall.
Oh, that will be interesting to watch for sure. But I very quickly, before we finish, Erica, I have to get to this health issue because a lot of people, again, decided not to go to Brazil or there was some significant concern for the athletes and those who went about Zika and other types of, you know, waterborne illnesses that they were concerned about. So just very quickly, what was your impression of the health situation? And do we have any concerns kind of longer term given, you know, people now are going to go back to their home countries having been exposed perhaps to something, or are we not worried about that?
I don't think we're worried about it. You know, overwhelmingly, people said they never even saw a single mosquito the whole time that they were there. I have to say I've been a bit more in Oklahoma since I've been back than I was in Rio. And so I think that, you know, we don't have to worry about that moving forward. You know, as for the water stuff, too, I mean, it would have been great if they had cleaned up the water. It would have been a wonderful legacy for Rio. I don't think it doesn't look like it's going to have any health impacts on athletes. So it looks like in that sense, Rio maybe got I don't know if we want to say a gold, but at least as close to the podium.
At least for now, from what we can tell. All right. Thank you so much, Erica, for giving us the update. Welcome back to Oklahoma. It's great to have you home. And we will continue to talk about and watch what's going on in Brazil and in Rio in particular. So thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Erica Larkins, a University of Oklahoma anthropologist who just returned from Brazil as part of a year-long project studying the preparation for the 2016 Summer Olympics. There's more information on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews as part of a collaborative effort with OU's College of International Studies. Sam Dupre produces the show with oversight from Brian Hardzinski, and we'd like to welcome our new research associate, Katie Holland, and our digital content intern, Audra Bruls. For Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Corlatt.